this is the system error, but as long as I remember that it's happening, the good part is that having remembered that it's happened, I always make sure that I look and those little numbers are going. Nothing more embarrassing than being a few minutes in and not knowing whether you've actually pressed start. Yeah. I had Earl Blumenauer's interviewing. It was great. Good and long good. It was going along good. The recorder was in my bag and I just couldn't bring myself to interrupt, to look and check. So I just forward with faith. Of course, I'm a professional. Of course I had it on. Like I said, I've rewritten this intro three times. I'm going to say part of it now. When I first moved to the Portland area in the mid-1980s, Clackamas County was a kind of rural backwater. It was regarded as kind of the country cousin. There was the rich went out west, Washington County. There was the gritty city. It was like a scale model of a city, at least, and that was Portland and Multnomah. And then there was the farmland and idyllic countryside in Clackamas County. And there is still farmland in Clackamas County, and there's still quite a bit of idyllic countryside. It's absolutely beautiful out here. But it's also a growing county in a major metropolitan area. It's developed, and there are a lot of people. The county attorney in Clackamas County for the past 17 years is John S. Foote, and I have the honor of having him as a guest on the show today. Mr. Foote, thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
First of all, now, you're the county attorney in Clackamas County. What's your, I guess, what's your job like? You're the head of the county attorney's office. You're, in some respect, you're the chief prosecutor for the county. The different law agencies, the sheriff's department, the cities in Milwaukee, Gladstone, Oregon City, police, they all are independent agencies, but the people they arrest, they bring before you. What's your job like here?
Well, first of all, in Oregon, we're not called county attorneys. They are in some states. But in Oregon, we're called district attorneys. Just a small thing, but that's the way we're described. Our position is in the Oregon Constitution. And the principle of being a district attorney is that we are the prosecuting authority for the county. We handle all the felonies and most of the misdemeanors. There are some misdemeanors that are filed in municipal courts in some of the cities here in Clackamas County. In Multnomah County, where a lot of your listeners are, that isn't quite the same. There aren't a lot of small cities. We have a lot of small cities here. So they have a lot of municipal courts, and some of them do misdemeanors, but we do the vast majority. Last year, we received about 7,000 criminal cases, and we filed about 6,000. Those are round numbers. And our job, we are the people that decide. We are the office that decides by statute, by design. It's our responsibility to decide whether a case can be filed and whether it should be filed in court and prosecuted. And our decision is not arbitrary. It's not whether we like the case or not. Our decisions are based on facts and law. And that's really important because our first responsibility is to try and find justice. And we can talk about what that means if you'd like. But it's a nice sounding word. Everybody has a different idea about it. But one of the things that is a component of justice is treating people consistently in similar situations. And that means that we have to have standards about how we handle cases, how we screen cases, how we file cases, and how we negotiate cases. So that's all kind of components of what we do. We're all attorneys, at least the people who go to court. We have a lot of people in the office. Over half the office are not lawyers. They're support staff, victim advocates. We have investigators. We have child support collection agents. Last year, we collected over $23 million in back-ordered child support that people weren't paying, where court ordered them to pay. So, and we appear in juvenile court, too. So that's kind of a really quick summary of what we do. Most of our work that people pay attention to is the criminal stuff. So
now, and that's and that's one of the things. Quick aside, now that I realize I brought the one where I have a my side is dead.
Okay.
But I'm listening on yours. Okay, I'll edit that part out. Well, I say there's quite a bit. There's quite a bit happening in Clackamas County. Quite a bit has been in the news. And let's start off with the tough ones. One of the things that your office has been doing over the last, well, decade and a half, you've had a number of cases that you've prosecuted of official misconduct. A few years back, the sheriff pointed out that he had had quite a few more. He had charged quite a few more officers back in the days of the 80s. Clackamas County's law enforcement had a rather bad reputation, the good old boy kind of thing. Now, that may still be there, but it appears to me, at least, that your offices are trying to do something about that. The fact is, this is a growing county. It is a developing place, and there's just not a place for that kind of thing in law enforcement. And I say, I think you're doing something about it. Don't want to ask about any specific cases, because that's just those can be just too sensitive. But do you think there has been any kind of evolution in the way law enforcement is approached out here in Clackamas from before your tenure through now? I mean,
I don't really know that, because obviously I don't know what was going on before I came. I started my work working for Mike Strunk in Multnomah County for 10 years, and that's kind of where I learned how to be a professional in my line of work. But maybe it would be helpful if I spoke for a minute about what I perceive as an area that's largely misunderstood or not, people don't know about. How do district attorney's offices work with law enforcement? What is the relationship? And it's not simple, because we have two components really that can compete with each other. The first is we are a partner with law enforcement, a really important relationship where we support each other. And what I mean by that is we try and help them do their work right, and they try and bring us cases that can be proven in court against people who are truly guilty. That's our goal. So it's important that we help educate police about what the law is, and it's important for them to educate us about all the challenges involved in investigating and handling crime. So there's this very close working relationship, which we encourage. We encourage law enforcement to come in and talk to us if they have questions, if they don't know what to do with something, or they need some ideas, or they just want to consult. Our door is always open. We think that's a very important part. So we have this very close collaborative relationship. But on the other hand, we are independent. And our office has this responsibility to act independently. First of all, we decline to prosecute cases that the police bring to us. Last year, I think we declined to prosecute 10 to 15% of all the felony cases that came in. Now, the reasons why we did that have to do with facts and law. Did we have enough facts? Was the evidence brought to us in a way that we can use in court according to search and seizure laws and other things? So it doesn't necessarily have to do with whether somebody's guilty or not. There's a difference between whether we think someone's guilty looking at things and whether or not we can prove it in court. And that's our job. So sometimes that can create tension with police, because they want us to prosecute something and we just don't think we can. So we always try and reach out to them, explain why, and maybe there are things they can do to make the case better, a variety of things. But that's one relationship where we're partners, but we're independent. And then the other is sometimes we're in the position where the crime could be committed by a prosecutor too. It's not just anybody. It doesn't matter who they are. But sometimes it can be an elected official. It could be anybody. So, and these things happen because we're all human beings. I believe every group of people is on a bell curve. So, you know, where that leaves some people, the small minority. So, and it can happen in law enforcement. So our job is to make sure that we're doing that fairly and well. And, you know, one of the things we talk about in our office all the time is while we're doing the work, while we're investigating and prosecuting, our information is we don't share it with the public because we need to protect the integrity of the investigations and make sure we've got our information and we control the information so that we can. It's much easier to figure out who's telling us the truth and who isn't if we can control the flow of information. But when it's over, first of all, when we file the charges, we give all that information to the defense. But then when the case is over, everything eventually is public. So whether we prosecute the case or not. And our what we tell our folks is make sure that you can explain whatever your decisions are. That's the key. Make sure you can stand up and explain it because we owe people an explanation if they ask. And we do a lot of this. We get a lot of phone calls and letters every day from people wanting to know why we did something. Sometimes it's the person who was prosecuted. Sometimes it's the victim. Sometimes it's just a citizen. And I think one of our jobs is to be able to explain these things because people don't understand. They either demonize us or they lionize us, and they don't understand the nature of what we do. So Mike Schrunk taught me that there's a lot of authority that comes with our jobs, but with that comes a lot of responsibility to do it carefully and well.
I want to ask you about Mike Schrunk for a moment, but before I do I just would love to follow up on a thing. The county commissioners a few weeks ago said that they wanted to appoint an independent consultant to review the sheriff's office and to review some really strong concerns. One of the things that engenders disrespect for law and in the rule of law is when people in enforcement are caught out either ignoring the job or committing crimes. And it's that perception. I mean, on the one hand, when they're caught and prosecuted, you have people say, oh, I knew that stuff was going on. On the other hand, being caught and prosecuted means the system is working. It may have taken time, and what happened in the past is sad, but at least it's working, finally. So how do we rebuild the respect for law that people should have and overcome? How do we overcome some of the negative stories that we hear?
Well, that there's a certain amount of that that comes with a job. This country was created on a rebellion against authority, and it's a rich tradition in the United States. And I personally don't think that's a bad thing. And I'm in a position of authority, and I think it's important to question because I do believe that old saying that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So I think one of the ways, if you're in a position like I'm in, you can't always change people's perceptions, but we have to be able to explain what we do. And it isn't just police officers. People in authority we have to do our best to put them in the same standards that we do other people. Now, not everyone agrees on the decisions we make, but that's what's in our mind. And I think that's the way we do it, and we explain what we do. And when we make a mistake, we admit it. So right now there's tension in the county about this issue. I'm trying to do my job, and I've tried to be open and direct with the sheriff about my concerns. And these things, they're not easy, and they're ripe for misunderstandings. But I believe the commissioner is going to try and do the right thing here, and we'll just see how it turns out.
Terrific. And, yeah, we all just have to hope for the best. I will continue following the story and see how things go out. And I don't want to stir up any fuss with your office and the sheriff. You're both trying to do your jobs, and And it's not easy because it involves people. And that's, talk about wild cards.
Law enforcement is very challenging. And being a leader in law enforcement is very challenging. And people just don't, most people do not understand the things that people in law enforcement, and to a lesser degree, but also our office, the things we see that people do to each other. It's stunning. People don't believe this world exists, but it does exist. And we understand that it isn't always understood by the public. And our job is to be able to explain what we do and try and come up with fair, just results. Mike Trunk always talked about, you know, make sure you do the right thing. It's a very simple sounding thing, but it pushes you towards that sense of what's right. And I believe in that.
Now let me, I kind of shift gears. I'd like to ask you about some stuff about Clackamas County's system here. You have drug courts here, and I'll be honest, that's kind of a underhand way of getting around to asking about your old boss, Mike Schrunk. I have done criminal justice research, drug policy research, policy analysis for many years. Drug courts are a subject I've studied extensively, and some of the early work looking at drug courts, how they operate, how they should operate, the processes and the outcomes. Some of the best research on that was done right in this area, looking at Multnomah County's drug courts, looking at the work Mike Schrunk had been doing up there. I mean, he's in criminal justice reform. I don't know if this is a bad thing to say, but in criminal justice reform circles, Mike Schrunk is revered. You had the chance to work with him for 10 years. I do want to ask about the drug courts, but oh heck. What was Mike Schrunk like to work with, to work for as a prosecutor? I mean, he was more than 30 years, he was the Multnomah County District Attorney. From Iowa, we had county attorneys, so that, right. That's still in my head. Right. I'll get it, you know, been here for one day, I'll get it straight. What was he like as a district attorney?
I will say that probably more than any other person, he helped shape what my ideas of what it is to be a DA, even though I never thought I'd be one working for him. So, and there's a lot that goes into that. It isn't just what Mike did himself. It's the kind of culture that he tried to create there, and the people he chose to help him lead the office, and the policies they implemented, and the kinds of decision making they did. They were a bunch of smart people who were committed to try and make things better in a very difficult area, facing up to really hard things, and then also trying to be creative about a lot of problems, for instance, drug addiction, that we really weren't very good at. Nobody's very good at it, so because it's incredibly hard. So answering what he was like is a, on the one hand, I admired him, and I soaked in a lot from him. But on the other hand, he's a pretty complicated person and very private, and he won't even like that I'm talking about him. So, because he just doesn't like attention, which is very unusual in a public person, but we all found very endearing. And that was another thing that when you're in a position of authority, it tends to feed your ego, but it's really not about you. We're in a position of service, this is something Mike believed, that we're in a position of service to the work that's being done. So our job is to use the authority we have to help the office provide the best services to the public. And the key to remember is, who do we work for? We work for the public. So, and we talk about that here all the time. Who do we work for? Whose money are we spending? So it's not ours. So it can shape a lot of things when you have that kind of fundamental way of looking at it.
Now drug addiction. We'll get back to the criminal justice stuff. I got my fanboy thing out of the way. So you do have a drug court here now. Defendants. That's your from this perspective. What kind of people end up being put through the drug courts here in Clackamas?
Well, it's a variety of people. We tend to not just deal with, we try not to take on people who aren't a little more enmeshed. We want people who are a little more enmeshed in it. It's hard to do. One of the difficult things with any program, whether it's drug court or anything else, that sounds very humanitarian and well-intentioned, is to try and separate those feelings. Because I worked for nonprofits for at-risk kids before I went to law school. I know the feeling of working with people like that and why it's so meaningful. But that process versus, is there scientific evidence that it reduces crime and recidivism? Now, I'm sort of not invited into a lot of rooms because I push this issue a lot. And it's not, people give lip service to it, in my opinion. But we need a lot more rigor about what actually works. And the only way to do that is more rigorous evaluations. And the word rigorous evaluations, I mean, all these words are used, but the most rigorous evaluation of a program is a randomized controlled trial. And they're rare. But if you don't do them, it's very difficult to separate whether it's the program that's changing the behavior or the behavior would have changed regardless of the program. So, you know, you might get good outcomes, but is the program doing that? And that's what you do in medicine. They do randomized controlled trials to try and figure out if it's the drug that's causing the effect. So it's the same principle, and it's still new to public safety. It's becoming much more common in education, places like that. And this is hard to say because we want to be good people. We want to be kind. We want to be caring. And as a person, I believe that. But as a criminal justice person, we're in the crime and justice business. So if it's not reducing crime and recidivism as a program, my question is, should we be spending the money in this part of the system? And that's a hard pull. You get a lot of criticism. I get a lot of criticism from people in the business because I say these things, but I keep saying them because I think they're right. I think in the long run, if we did this, we would have fewer programs, but perhaps better results. We have to make a commitment to it. And then if we're going to do a program that we just want to do because we think it's right and caring, but we don't know if it reduces crime, then we just say that. But then the question is, does it belong in criminal justice or does it belong somewhere else? So, these are hard questions. And addiction itself is so difficult. I tell people, the hardest thing to do is change human behavior, right? All we have to do is look at ourselves. How hard is it for us to change? I quit smoking 44 years ago.
Congratulations.
I still remember the date. Because it was one of the hardest things I've ever did. I quit 100 times. Well, I never quit until I finally quit, but I tried to quit. This is just the nature of, first of all, changing human behavior, and second of all, particularly when there are addictions. And we just need to admit that this is hard work. I'm not saying we need to lock a bunch of people up, but we need to get a lot more honest about this stuff. And a lot of the solutions are much broader in society than criminal justice. By the time we touch somebody, they're into it. We almost never get someone at the beginning of this process. We get them once they're into it, whether it's crime or addiction or both. So those are just some thoughts that cross my mind. Yes, we need to do things, but I think we need to keep asking the question, where's the evidence that it's going to change crime and recidivism? And maybe there's something else that's better that we could spend the money on. But most of these programs are not run by our office. We participate. and we support them. We have a wide variety of treatment courts here. We have a mental health court. We have a community court. And I think one of Mike Schrunk's most innovative programs was the neighborhood or community prosecution program he set up in Portland that took prosecution in a different way. Rather than just reacting to crime, he said, why don't we go out into the community and try and work with the community on some solutions that actually reduce the effects in the community. He did this with the nuisance abatement and the against drug houses in Portland. We have that program in Clackamas County. We've had it for about 15 years. I stole that idea from Mike. And it creates a connection with the community where you empower the community to think of ways that they could ask government to help them. We're doing it now with zombie houses here in the county and the people that are popping up in them. And that's up in your neighborhood. We're taking it a little bit at a time. We put some money in our budget to help pay for some of the work. But we're only one piece of this. And our fundamental job, what we spend most of our time on, is holding people accountable for serious crime. And we need to do that first. But this other stuff, we're humans, too. We're citizens, too. We care about this stuff.
Given my background, one might presume that I'm very much a proponent of drug courts. Actually, there are so many concerns, the prospect of net widening, because it's easier to process people, so put more people into the system and mm-hmm. bring it back to that point of instability. The cherry picking, like, all right, this one will be a successful graduate because doesn't really have any problems. And then there's the resource trouble. I mean, let's be seen as doing something, so we'll create this thing, but not give it any support and not give any kind of resources to the people coming through it. So if they fail, well. And that's the, it's a tricky thing. It's a really tricky thing. You're right. I mean, these are complicated. They're not cut and dried. And that's the toughest part of this. Now, that leads me over toward House Bill 2355, mm-hmm. the new law that the governor still hasn't signed, but I'm sure that she will, because she's not going to play some weird petty power game with the Attorney General. I can say that. Anyway, I really think she is, actually. Now, two aspects in that bill. It's the one is the racial profiling component and data collection, and I certainly want to talk to you about that one. But we're in the it's a sentence. This segues towards sentencing. The other part was the penalty reduction. In a sense, some people have called it a partial decriminalizing, not removing criminal penalties, but de-escalating, de-emphasizing, reducing from a felony to a misdemeanor for first offense, simple possession. Now, the one person who spoke against that was Josh Marquis from is it Clatsop? On the one hand, well, we want to have these. On the other hand, he was also saying, well, we don't really charge that anyway. Nobody's actually, we're not going to really put people in. So the question gets begged, if you're not doing that and they're not really going to, why keep it a felony and pretend? Why not make the... did you have a position on HB 2355 on this thing, or did you stay out of it?
Well, I didn't go down and testify, and I wasn't active in the conversation. But I can kind of summarize. First of all, I think race and criminal justice is an incredibly important issue. I grew up in the 50s and 60s in the East Coast with the civil rights movement. My parents were very involved. It's a kind of a core value of mine. And racism is one of the purest forms of injustice. So if we're in the justice business, we care about racism as a person and as a professional. But getting into the data about what the numbers mean is, first of all, data can mislead as well as inform. And you need to be careful about it. And so the question is, can we have a really honest conversation about the data and what it might mean without being called names? And that's very hard right now. But I think more information is really important. And I, in principle, I support the part of the bill that starts to try and gather contact information between police and community people, because I think that could help inform. The second thing I did was I've been pushing for a victimization study, and we're now setting one up with the Criminal Justice Commission in Salem. They're good people, and they're thinking about this, because we only talk about racial components with offenders. We never talk about the racial components with victims. And the truth is, there's disparity on both sides. So what does that mean? And these are tough questions. So I believe we need to talk about them. I need to be open about them. And I'll give you an example. And I'll bet you no one has told you this, but I have the data. Since Measure 11 passed in 1995, which I'm sure you don't like, or most people don't like, most people, perhaps a lot of your listening audience, a lot of people in Clackamas County like it, but racial disparity in the prison population has dropped dramatically. Now, it's still, there is disparity still, but it's dropped dramatically. No one ever talks about that. No one ever talks about the fact that those kinds of laws, with 57, which is a mandatory minimum set law, but it is an enhanced sentencing, and it kind of narrows the choices of the court a little bit and the things it can consider. The result of that is that certain groups of people who used to get breaks, and you can guess who they are, they don't get them anymore. The disparity starts to shrink. So how do we put that in the pipe and smoke it? I mean, how does that figure into all this? That goes in a complete opposite direction of most people who are upset about racial disparity. That mandatory minimums and tougher sentencing laws reduce disparity in Oregon. They did. So setting that issue aside, because that's a big subject and very difficult to talk about without people getting very upset. And I understand why they got upset. This is a personal thing. But let's go back to the drugs, because on the drug side, I thought it was kind of a dumb idea, because I don't think it's going to change anything. And I think it's going to make Oregon perceived as a place that's more friendly to people who want to use meth and heroin, which I don't think is a great idea. The current law before this law was passed in Oregon basically was that if you possessed meth and heroin, you committed a felony on paper, but you were ineligible for a prison sentence. You could not go to prison for it. You could only be put on probation. And the reason is the law was changed in 1989, and drug possession was taken out of the category of crimes that's eligible for a prison sentence. So we haven't been sending people to prison in Oregon for drug crimes for a long time. We're number two in the country in the lowest percentage of our prison population to send prison for drugs, and they are drug dealers. And even if you're a drug dealer, you probably aren't going to go unless you're dealing a lot of dope and you have a criminal history. So that's kind of the nature of the way things were. What does this change? I don't really know. And the truth is, because these crimes were felonies with no real consequences in terms of imprisonment, we handled them as a tool to leverage people into getting to facing their drug use because of the threat of this conviction. And we did a variety of things. We give people deferred sentencing so that they, if they did all the conditions, their felony turns into a misdemeanor at the end of their supervision. We would do conditional discharges. We did a variety of things and gave people chances. You can get your conviction expunged after 3 years, even if you get convicted of the felony. So there were a wide variety of avenues for people, which we all use because we're not trying to demonize people. But drug use is a scourge, and it is a scourge on our society. It is, meth and heroin are incredibly dangerous drugs. They kill people, and they destroy lives. And there's just no other way to put it. And why would we do anything to make it less social, to decrease social disapproval of it? So that's kind of my feeling. But I understand the feeling of wanting to, quote, defelonize. I understand that. I'm not sure what that's going to do. I don't know. And I'll tell you what, the way the law is written, I don't know how the police are going to figure out what to do, because we're in the process of trying to help them, understanding what the law is and what they have to do to bring us a case. And it's gotten so complicated that I don't know. I don't know what, I mean, we'll sort through it, but it's really complicated now about how much they have and how much is this and how much is that, and you have to weigh it. And I mean, it's usually we would have the crime lab weigh it, but the crime lab can't weigh all these cases. So do we hire a bunch of more criminals? I don't know. It's just, and I think a lot of people will be less inclined. There's a fear. I don't think it's going to be our drug court necessarily because of the way ours is set up. But there are a lot of people around the state who feel that when this goes to misdemeanors, people aren't going to have any reason to go to drug court because the leverage isn't there. So I don't know. I just don't know if this was really well thought out on this side of it. To me, it's like we're in this big bad rush to legalize everything. Well, since marijuana got legalized, which I also thought was a dumb idea, but I understand, and it's the law. So, but there's more marijuana in Oregon than ever. And that's what will happen if we keep legalizing drugs. There will be more drugs. So are we concerned about drug usage? I mean, and I know that the solutions aren't great. We don't want to demonize people, but I don't know. These are not easy choices for any of us. And in my role, I don't like to see things that make drug usage any less serious. So, but, you know, we don't write the laws. We try and enforce them. And I didn't go down and testify against the bill because I just figured there are other things that were more important, and there was plenty of robust debate about it already. And quite frankly, the legislature knew what it was going to do before this ever started, so it didn't really make any difference what some of us said, so I saved my breath.
I mean, it does, at some level, it does feel like it's one of those, we must do something, we must be seen to do something, here's a thing, let's do that. Mm-hmm. And it means we're seen to do something, and that's... And you know, when you just for a moment to go back to sentencing and the mandatories, on the one hand, well, I do think that many mandatory minimums are extremely harsh and unnecessarily so. The one argument about them that I've always had a little trouble with was the fact that, well, it takes the power out of the hands of the judge and puts them in the hands of the prosecutor, and so that gives a great deal of power in there, and the judge's hands are somewhat tied. And I mean, I understand that. I've made that argument myself. I understand it. The problem with it, which I've never really said out loud, is that that argument only works if you presume that every judge is a fair and unbiased and absolutely, you know, perfect arbiter and doesn't have these kind of, you know, the old boy network and the other problems that criminal justice system has been plagued with for so many, race and class and gender. And it's... I don't think you can really say that. I've seen too many instances around the country. This region, I think we probably have a lot of great judges up here, as far as I know. But I got friends all over the country, and there are some judges. No, I would not like to have sentencing kept in their hands. Exactly what you pointed out. There will be country club folks who will just skate right on out the door, whereas folks who would not be able to join those country clubs will get pretty harsh sentences. And
do you know that half the judges, there was a study a few years ago of Measure 11, and it indicated that in over half the Measure 11 cases, the judges gave the defendants more time than the mandatory minimum, half of the Measure 11 cases. So there are a lot of things said about Measure 11 that just aren't accurate. And since Measure 11 passed in 1995, went into law in 1995, passed in 1994, violent crime in Oregon has dropped more than 50%.
Well, now, violent crime generally has dropped a lot.
It was not dropping in Oregon at the time it passed here.
Well,
I'll give you a report.
Well, I'd love to have it, but the thing is, the economy did it. You know, did improve tremendously in the late 90s. And
do you know what
happened
in 2008 when the economy went in the toilet? Crime went down.
Yeah.
There is no scientific evidence that the economy controls crime. In the United States. Now, there might be places in the world where that's true, where people steal because they're starving or really desperate. We have a pretty robust safety net, not perfect, safety net in the United States and in Oregon. So people don't steal almost for those reasons. And violent crime isn't caused by the economy. It's caused by just a wide variety of things that have nothing to do with that. So when you incarcerate somebody, they don't commit another crime while they're incarcerated. That is just an incontrovertible fact. And every study says incarceration reduces crime. It does. So the question is not whether there should be incarceration, unless you're somebody who just doesn't believe in it, and there are people who do. And I understand that's humanitarian. It's hard to lock somebody up, except when you look at the crimes, but the facts of the crimes. But the question really is, what is the right blend for our society? And that's an open debate. Oregon, I think, has done a pretty good job in the last 25 years of reducing crime rates, but keeping our incarceration rate well below the national average. So we've done a pretty good job, and it's starting to unravel because of efforts by the legislature to undo incarceration under false premises. First of all, incarceration rate is below the national average, about 20% below the national average. And second of all, the most recent prison forecast, which comes out twice a year, and I'll give you a copy. It's done by the Office of Economic Forecasters at the State of Oregon. They're independent of the criminal justice system, and they do a scientific estimate based on the data they get of where the prison forecast, where the prison's going to go over the next 10 years. They do it every 6 months. So they adjust. So what does it say? It comes out in April and October. So we have April of 2017. And this is what it says. Over the next 10 years, Oregon's prison population is going to grow 4%. Oregon's general population is projected to grow 12%. So Oregon's incarceration rate is projected to reduce 7%. Those are the facts, as best we know them. Now, we'll see what happens. But despite that information, all we're hearing is that we're busting at the seams with prison populations, as if prisons are the only thing in our society that's not allowed to grow, while every other piece of... I mean, I challenge any other state agency to limit itself to that kind of growth over the next 10 years. It won't happen. So, but why are prisons different? Unless you just don't believe in prisons, which is fine, but then say that's the reason. Don't say for some of these other reasons. We're not in this catastrophic prison growth. More interestingly is the women's prison population growth. That forecast says that over the next 10 years, the women's prison population is projected to grow less than 1%. A total of 11 inmates. Now, there are ups and downs by month, you know, but that's its projection. Now, did you hear that during the legislature?
Well, and there is, of course, a controversy over building a new women's prison.
Well, that's okay. I worked in corrections for 5 years in the middle of my career as an assistant director. I'm familiar. There is an empty women's prison in Salem. They don't have to build a new one. There's an entire empty one. Now, they'd have to clean it up and retrofit it, number one. Number two, why did they build a women's prison so small in the first place? It's sort of like why they build cars to break down. Somebody did, I mean, that was just dumb. it's been around, what, 10 or 15 years? That was just not good planning. That's not somebody else's fault. Furthermore, if it's only going to grow that much, can't they manage that? I mean, but we're into ideology, not facts. People don't want incarceration? Fine. But they misrepresent the facts. And the facts are not that we're on some prison-busting problem. That's not the problem. Other parts of government are going to grow much faster than prisons at the current policy level. But they're using this scare about prisons to push the message that we need to reduce sentences. Here's my concern. We're going to get more crime. Because we only send serious offenders to prison in Oregon. Trust me, we have the highest percentage. I think we're first in the country of the states that are ranked by the Bureau of Justice Statistics. I think there are 38 states. We're ranked number one in the percentage of our prison population that is in prison for violent crime. So isn't that what prison's for? Now, the second thing is that we only send serious property offenders to prison. And I'll give you an example. We asked for the 59 women. We asked for all the women that went to prison from Clackamas County in 2016. It was 59. And then we created a chart with a summary of their cases and then how many criminal convictions they had. Guess how many criminal convictions those 59 female offenders had? 457. That's an almost 8 per offender. Now, my point of that is you have to be a serious repeat property offender to go to prison in Oregon. We give them breaks all the time. And this idea that we need to reduce the sentences, for some reason other than people just want to reduce the sentences, is just false. Now, if people would just say, I'm anti-incarceration, I don't like prisons, and that's my agenda, I completely understand that. It's like being against the death penalty. Prisons are tough. They're hard. It's hard to do this, take people's freedom away. I'm not going to tell someone not to feel that way, but they can't get the vote saying that. They got to do this other stuff. They got to strap all this other stuff onto it that's factually not true. There's just no data to support it. And that's what really bothers me. It's not an honest conversation. And we're shouted down when we say something, as if we're trying to lock everybody up. And I'm not saying that. Give you an example. In 2007, Kevin Mannix had a ballot measure called 61. It had mandatory minimums for property crime because we had a big property crime problem. And it was growing. Person crime was dropping, but property crime was still high. So, and we all knew that in my business. And so I looked at it, and he was still collecting signatures, and I thought, and I was the incoming president of the ODAA, and I thought, I don't want mandatory minimums for property crime. And there are a lot of complicated reasons, but I just thought it was too rigid. And so we had a repeat property statute on the books from the legislature in 2005, but it was 1995, but it was toothless. You had to have 5 felony convictions before you were even eligible for a prison sentence. So I got the DAs together, and we took the repeat property offender statute that was on the books, and we just made it stronger. No mandatory minimums. Still with structured discretion by the judge. And we took it to the legislature, and after a lot of tough negotiations, they agreed to put it on the ballot as an alternative to 61. I went out and campaigned for 57 and against 61. 57 defeated 61, largely because a lot of us went out and campaigned for it. Guess what the legislature did before the ink was even dry? They suspended 57. Now, we've got it back now because some of the legislators who did that got unelected, so they reinstated it. But they just took another piece out of 57 in the last session. It's House Bill 3078, and they don't call it that. They call it the fair and just safe, and it has safe and justice in it. It doesn't say anything about reducing sentences in Measure 57, but that's what it did. So this is a tough time to sort of try and tell the truth and let people make informed decisions. But I think that's my job, is to try and do that, even when people get upset about it. So that's where I'm at.
You may be surprised to hear I can sympathize with you and fully. I'm a drug policy reform person. I've been doing that kind of thing for a long time, but I'm also a policy researcher and analyst. I try to find the facts and the real data, which when Measure 91 passed, one of the arguments that was made is we have to do this because of the racial disparities, and this will resolve some of these problems with racial disparities. That, you know, because there's racially disparate ways in which these laws are enforced, and which is quite true. Some of these laws do appear to be, there's, the numbers don't lie. If you arrest proportionally more people from one demographic group than you do from another, but they are breaking the law at roughly the same rates, that's an appearance of bias. I mean, that's where these things come from. But changing the law didn't change that. It meant that fewer people are arrested for these things because they're no longer crimes. But the people that are still getting arrested, there's still a sort of a disparity there where the numbers are reduced, but there's still a, it seems the disparity hasn't gone away. So the people who made those arguments that we need to pass this because of that, okay, I accept that this is a problem, but passing that didn't actually change it. Fewer people are arrested, but those disparities they talked about, well, some of that stuff's still there, and that's the I'm not terribly popular sometimes with my reformer friends because I point these things out. It's, you know, that there are some flaws in the logic, and it's that whole follow through. We must do something. Let's be seen to do this, and great, and then walk away because we've done this, but it hasn't solved.
You know, I completely agree, and it is a hard conversation. Ideology can be very exciting. And people can be very passionate about it. That's part of the human condition. It's hard when you sit down and say, well, what does this data show? And now sometimes you decide there are problems with the data. And sometimes you decide we need more information. This isn't enough. Or you decide something else. But I believe you have to look at it. But that's hard sometimes with people who are so ideologically driven. The difficulty I have in this situation is that people are not telling a straight story about the facts. They're making sweeping statements about things that are not... You wait and read that prison forecast, and then you ask yourself if anybody ever says this stuff. It's just those are the facts. And anyone who says anything different has no better information than that prison forecast, which is the best scientific approach we have to the problem. And it is a numbers question. So it's probably more susceptible to being accurately done with data than most. When you get into the human condition, it's a little different. But data is important, and it shouldn't help us understand if we're headed in the right direction or if not. The whole question about race, and it's just really hard. And one of the things I think we need to keep in mind is, why do we think that police as a group, law enforcement as a group of prosecutors, are necessarily any different than all the rest of us? And is there racism in our society? Yes. I believe there is. I think we're all accountable to ourselves and to the people around as to how we look at ourselves and how we examine what we do. Some of us are more committed to that than others. But why should we think, you know, police are not perfect? The question is, and then also, why is there disparity? It's not always an easy question. Is there more crime in some neighborhoods than others? Or do some neighborhoods ask for more enforcement because of that, which then results in more arrests? And then the piece that we've been missing is victimization. Are minorities being victimized disproportionately? And what does that mean? And I think what we need to do is be able to talk about this, agree that racism is something we cannot tolerate and will not tolerate. And each in leadership in each office has to be willing to do that and stand on it. But I don't think we do it by demonizing groups of people or demonizing a whole system without having a lot more information. But this is hard to talk about. It's just hard to talk about. But I'm willing. I'm probably dumb for doing it because then I get called names. But I just think that's my responsibility.
And I'm grateful to you for it. I mean, it's a necessary conversation. It's the only way things move forward. I mean, we can, reformers and such can say that, well, things are improving and moving better because we're pushing for that kind of stuff, and people involved in the system can say we're making improvements and getting better because we're professionals and that's what we should be doing. And if we can get everybody to kind of work together and have these conversations, I think we can really do a lot better. Because you're right. I mean, we talk past each other a lot. And the sweeping generalizations that, they may not be great arguments, but it's one way of making a point when you have no evidence. And that's No, I'm grateful to heavens that you're willing to do this, and I've taken up a great deal of your time today. So I better ask the last question, which was, of course, do you have any closing thoughts for the listeners? And remind folks again that I'm speaking with John Foote. He is the district attorney for the county of Clackamas, which is where I live, and I just say this has been an absolute pleasure having the chance to chat with you. So, yeah, do you have any closing thoughts for my listeners?
Well, the only thing I would say is that I encourage people to be curious, to ask questions. Ask us, ask our offices questions. You know, if you have a question about a case, ask. We owe it to people to explain it. And don't just listen to one side. And make up your own minds about things. And, I'd also say recognize we live in a very imperfect society in which bad things happen. And people need a sense of justice. And justice usually means the person's held accountable in a way that represents what they did and that the punishment in their mind is proportional to what they did. And now we know from talking to thousands of victims every year that there's a wide range of feelings about that, that some people who have lost a loved one are very forgiving, and some people who've had a car stolen want to go out and get the lynch party. So, but taking out the extremes, there is a middle, and that's our first job. Our first job, believe it or not, is not public safety. Our first job, it is in each case we handle to try and find a place that represents what is a fair estimate of justice in a very imperfect world. And it has those components to it. So proportional punishment has a purpose beyond just public safety. It has a justice component. And for those of us who grew up in the 1980s, in which the system was broken, both in crime rates and in justice, we learned that lesson firsthand by listening to thousands of victims. And things are much better now. And we're much better at helping victims understand how the system works. And they have constitutional rights now that they didn't used to have. They have a right to be informed and to participate and to speak. Those have been enormous advances in terms of closing the gap between people, what people believe and what actually happens. So I encourage people to communicate, to ask questions, not to accuse necessarily, but to ask questions. I mean, they can accuse if they want to, but it's a free country. But I think asking questions and being prepared that maybe what you think isn't necessarily factually accurate. Because in our business, everything starts with what are the facts? What are the facts? That's our orientation. And so that's how I look at things. What are the facts? And the facts then you can draw some conclusions. So I would just encourage people to communicate with each other, not demonize. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
John, it is the pleasure's been mine. And it is, again, quite an honor. I just thank you very much.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Yeah. It's been fun.